Before we get into today's episode, I want to let you know about a source of powerful free resources to help you as a parent or grandparent get equipped to invest in the faith of the next generation. Our Next Gen website has been designed to help empower you to navigate tough issues with the young people in your life. At Next Gen, you'll find articles, entertainment reviews from a Christian perspective, parenting stories, helpful parenting guides, and even answers to the tough questions. All these resources are free as you engage on the front line of raising the next generation for Jesus. So why not register today at premierinsight.org/resources to receive free resources from NextGen. That's premierinsight.org/resources. And now it's time for today's podcast.
We've got hundreds of millions of people throughout the world claiming to have experienced divine healing.
We just have to be open to the possibility that there could be something. We just don't know what's going on there. And so that unknown is, you know, always going to be present, and that's okay. Just to say, I don't know.
If you've pre-concluded there's no God, then you've already pre-concluded, you know, I could show you cases of arms growing back. Theoretically speaking, and you would not believe it. You would come up with natural explanations.
You're listening to Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Such an interesting debate for you today on miracles as we hear about a new video documentary, Send Proof. Welcome along to the show. I'm Justin Brierley. This is the place where we bring you conversations that matter every week. And we've got a really interesting one coming up on the 1st of March, and you can be part of it. We're doing an Ask Philip Yancey Anything Unbelievable live webinar. It's on Tuesday, 1st of March, 8 p.m. UK. That's 3 p.m. Eastern and 12 noon in Pacific terms. Free to attend, but you do need to register in advance to be part of it. You can find out more at unbelievable.live. It's going to be a chance to put your questions to Philip Yancey, prolific author, tremendous influence he's had with many Christians, helping them understand and better engage their faith. I'll be talking to him about his new autobiography, Where the Light Fell, which journeys through his early life and subsequent work as a writer and journalist and turbulent times he's seen, the post-World War II era, the civil rights movement of the 1960s, and how he's become an influence on the evangelical global church, but also a voice for those who've been scarred by its failings. So this should be a really interesting time with Philip Yancey, and we'll make sure to ask as many of your questions as possible as part of that. Want to be part of it? Tuesday, the 1st of March at 8 p.m. UK time, 3 p.m. Eastern. Get yourself registered over at unbelievable.live. Looking forward to seeing lots of unbelievable listeners there. Next week, by the way, we're hoping to announce ticketing also for our big live event on Saturday, the 14th of May, Unbelievable the Conference. Watch this space for that as well. Right now, let's get into today's conversation. Today, we're asking, Send Proof. Is there evidence for modern miracles? A new video documentary, Send Proof, investigates the medical evidence for modern miracle claims. Director Elijah Stevens joins me to talk about what he discovered and why he's asking for more people to submit their stories and medical evidence for miracle healing. But what would it take to make an atheist like Michael Shermer believe a supernatural healing has taken place? Michael, who's editor of Skeptic magazine, and he's interviewed along with other skeptics, healers, and theologians for the film. Craig Keener is one of them. His two-volume book on miracles was a benchmark contribution to research on miracle claims. He'll be explaining why he thinks there is enough evidence for a reasonable person to believe in miracles. So that's our subject today. Is there reliable evidence for modern miracle healings, or is the proof that's been sent in simply lacking at this point? We're going to talk this through with my three guests on the show. First of all, the director Elijah Stevens joins us. Elijah, thank you very much for this and for the documentary. Tell us a little bit of your background, what led you to want to make this particular documentary film.
Miracles have been a part of my life, at least claims of miracles, since I was a young child. There are people in my life who gave money to ministers that I thought were cons. There were, I wondered if God was real. I don't want to give away too much from the movie. I served in a church for a while, and a very close friend of mine left the faith, said there's no God, there's no miracles. And I wanted to see if there was something like that, if there was good evidence to believe. And I wanted Christians to actually, the name of the movie is Send Proof, is that if you believe in miracles, to actually send in evidence and let these things be researched and become case studies, because I think you learn a lot about reality one way or the other. And so that's kind of the call of the movie, and hopefully becomes a movement.
Craig and Michael both feature, and you've been trying to look at both perspectives on this. This isn't just a movie detailing the Christian perspective on this, is it?
Right. And I wanted healthy people in it that I thought they come across as, learned and wise, and not to put, the fringe people from both sides. I wanted to have a good conversation, and I hope it sparks good conversation and people, follow the truth wherever it leads and critically think. And I wanted to highlight issues. I think, each voice, we're all humans thrown into this life, and we have hard questions to ask, and each voice adds to that conversation a piece you're not going to see from your own worldview. And so it's very great to have both of them on.
Well, I'm really looking forward to the conversation with Michael and Craig on the show in just a moment. Why don't we take just a moment, though, to hear and watch a little bit of the promo for Send Proof.
I mean, there are hundreds of millions of people who claim to have experienced divine healing. Are you going to dismiss all of that?
The doctor said, there is nothing we can do. You're blind, and you're going to be blind for the rest of your life.
So you spent 13 years blind. Tell me about the night when everything changed.
There you go. That's the promo for Send Proof. And by the way, it's sendproof.com if you want to see the documentary. I understand, Elijah, that some people have been mishearing that as Sin Proof, I guess... Don't confuse it with whatever documentary Sin Proof is. You're looking for Send Proof. But let's talk to Michael now. Michael Shermer has been a guest several times on Unbelievable over the years, quite frequently on these kinds of issues around supernatural claims and so on. Michael, you were part of this documentary. It's not always a good experience when skeptics go on Christian documentaries. Sometimes they feel like they've been hoodwinked a bit afterwards, but you've been good enough to come on this show to talk about it, so I assume it wasn't too bad an experience. What was your response to the documentary once you were able to watch it?
Oh, I didn't feel hoodwinked at all. I thought it was a beautiful documentary and well-produced, artfully constructed and presented, and I didn't feel like I was misrepresented at all. I think that's all fine. The larger problem you're dealing with here is defining the subject that you want to study, in this case, miracles. What do you mean by a miracle? And, depending on the answer I get here from Craig or Elijah, then I guess we could go from there. But that seems to me the crux of the problem. Once you've defined it in some operational definition way, something that we can measure, quantify, test, if we can do that, then it's kind of in the realm of science, probably. But if not, then it's not really in the realm of science. It's kind of in the realm of religion, and I recognize religious truths as being slightly different than scientific truths, or actually quite a bit different, in the sense that, people may hold certain beliefs that they treat as true, but they're more mythically true or religiously true. Just part of our dogma, this is what we believe. We're Catholic or we're Protestant or we're Hindu or whatever. This is, what we believe. This is our truth. And in a sense, if it's not an empirical claim, if somebody says, I just accept this because it's mythically true for my religion, I'm not claiming I can prove it. Well, then that would be a different realm, if you see what I'm saying.
But in this documentary, I suppose the whole point is that Elijah is striving for some kind of empirical proof.
Yeah, that's right.
Ultimately, do you think it passes muster? Have you ever seen anything that looks close to perhaps providing some kind of empirical proof for supernatural healing?
I watched the film, but I didn't have time to, you know, like fact check the different claims in there, which would take quite a bit of work. Mm-hmm. You know, like, you know, the doctor holds up the X-ray, you know, what X-ray was that? When was that shot? You know, before or after? What was the follow-up on this particular story 6 months later, a year later? I don't know. You know, you hear these kinds of miracle claims all the time. You can read them everywhere. And many of them, you know, you guys would all reject, you know, if I rattled off the miracle healings of, you know, Satya Sai Baba in India, you guys would all go, oh, come on, you know, this guy's doing magic tricks. He's palming the ashes. You know, he's doing this. He's doing that. That the kind of things that Penn and Teller do as entertainment. And and most Christians reject the miracles of other religions. So there is a process going on in everybody's mind where most of you are skeptical, like me, of most of the claims you hear. So what, you know, Elijah's after there is, well, you know, here's a handful of ones that we just can't explain. They don't fall into the realm of obvious con artist or magician. And yet the medical doctors say, well, we don't have an explanation for it. Okay. So does mystery equal magic or miracle? You know, so that's a core question that a scientist would ask, you know, because, you know, medicine's not a perfect science and, you know, lots of things happen inside the body that nobody understands. We just have no idea why this guy got better and that person didn't. You know, cancers go into remission. Why? Well, I don't know. No one knows. Sometimes they do. Sometimes we can pinpoint it. You know, it was because of this treatment or whatever. But sometimes we can't. And what do you do with that? That's the problem.
And I'm sure, in a way, so much will depend on the assumptions, the worldview that someone brings to the same evidence, potentially. And Craig Keener, let's introduce you at this point. You have become one of the go-to people in the world, really, when it comes to research for miracle claims. You wrote that massive two-volume miracle book on both on New Testament model miracle claims and modern miracle claims. If people want to search through the Unbelievable archives, they'll find a show from several years ago, which we did for that at the time. But tell us what your response is to this new documentary from Elijah. You're in it. You've obviously watched it. Is it kind of consonant with what you've been trying to do in your research on miracles?
I think it takes it beyond what I'm able to do. I'm not a medical doctor. So I've been able to use the research methods that are research methods in my own discipline, historiographic research methods and so on. But for scientific evidence, I think what Global Medical Research Institute is doing is really important. And so sending the proof is really important. But again, as Michael pointed out, you know, there's the issue of defining miracles, and there's the issue of establishing what level of evidence will be sufficient for what you're talking about. So, you know, if it's part of your experience, you know, or part of your evidence that you've already looked at, that there's plenty of evidence for what we call miracles, then you're going to be more open to new ones, and your level of expectation will be correspondingly a bit lower than if this is like completely out of our experience. You know, nobody ever experiences these things. I wouldn't say, for example, that something has to be medically unique to be a miracle, because if God did something twice, well, then you'd say, well, it's not medically unique. Look, it happened twice. And I just bring that one up because there was a case where a girl, I think she was 9 years old, she was praying for healing. She'd just been tested. She had auditory nerve damage. She was deaf without her hearing aid. And she was healed. And it was an instant healing. And the audiologist said, I have no explanation for this. But one of the responses to that, and this wasn't from Michael, but from somebody else, one of the responses to that was, well, look, we've got six other cases of this in the, you know, archives of world medicine where auditory nerve damage disappeared. But I think the conjunction with prayer, the fact that it's so rare, and you know, that we don't have an explanation for how it works. We also don't know the contexts of those others, because medical documentation usually doesn't mention, you know, the context of prayer or something like that. We have different criteria of evidence used in different disciplines, but in historiography, law, journalism, sociology, anthropology, and so on, one of those criteria is eyewitness evidence. And there was a Pew Forum survey in 2006 that suggests that we've got hundreds of millions of people throughout the world claiming to have experienced divine healing. Now, again, as Michael pointed out, none of us would say all those are really healing. But to me, what it does, it means that we can't start with Hume's premise of uniform human experience to say, you know, human experiences. I mean, personally, I don't think even Hume would start with that premise today and say, okay, well, since uniform human experience is against this, we're not going to accept miracle claims. We're not going to trust miracle claims. We're going to put the bar of evidence so high. And in a number of those cases, maybe not in hundreds of millions, but at least in millions of cases, these were people who started with very different presuppositions, and sometimes were willing to abandon centuries of ancestral beliefs to become Christians because of what they experienced. There was another survey that was done where over half of physicians claimed to have witnessed things that they believed were miracles. So all that to say, I think that there are epistemological questions. And I think that there are other lines of evidence besides this, but you would think, and you'd have the right to think, that if you've got all these claims, at least sometimes you're going to be able to work through and get before and after medical records. And again, that's something that's beyond my, I mean, I've gotten them sometimes from other people, but I'm not a doctor. So yeah. I'm really grateful for what GMRI is doing, and very grateful for Elijah trying to get more people to send in evidence.
So briefly explain what Craig's talking about there, mm-hmm. GMRI. That's mm-hmm. the institute where you're sure. encouraging people to send in documentary evidence. And maybe talk about a couple of the cases that are particularly focused on in the mm-hmm. documentary. I'm thinking of Bruce Van Natter, mm-hmm. who had his intestines crushed, and you mm-hmm. can explain what happened there and the circumstances of his healing. And then another extraordinary story related to that later on in the documentary. But yeah, first of all, tell us about this institute.
So they study prayer done in Jesus' name, and so they'll take a, you know, someone who says, I have had a miracle. And first of all, they'll gather their medical records. And this is where science, I think, can speak to miracles. Was the person sick in the first place? Is the person cured now? What does the medical literature have to say? And then they take it and they go, well, this is extraordinary. Let's publish this. And so I do think there's a voice for the scientific community that the church finds quite valuable in almost, you know, both Protestant and Catholics do the same thing. And so they found several cases. One was Bruce Vanetta. He had a semi fall on him. They removed most of his intestines after prayer. He reports it growing back. Chris Gunderson was born with a paralyzed stomach. I can't remember the name right now. It's escaping me.
It's in the documentary. The chronic pseudo-obstruction syndrome.
That's exactly it. And so he gets prayer and is instantly able to eat. And, you know, when I'm talking to the researchers at GMRI, they say, look, Mayo Clinic says this does not repair itself. And so I think those are great cases. I also agree that this is a greater epistemological issue. If you believe in God or not, opens up the probability or not, you can even allow for miracles. If you think the resurrection happened, that's going to shift your worldview. But if you're inside the Christian worldview and there's nothing like this, there are none of these events, you go, well, maybe modern miracles don't occur. And if you are inside, you go, well, maybe this makes other conversations more probable. What about the resurrection? Stuff like that. And so I think it's helpful in the dialogue. It's not an ace of spades, if that makes sense.
And you've obviously covered those two examples very briefly there, but obviously in much more depth in the documentary, and they are quite remarkable in the extraordinary change that is there in both cases. So the ability to digest and have essentially normal eating habits and so on, where there was absolutely no opportunity for that before. Doctors say they are astonished. Now, not all doctors will necessarily use the word miracle, but certainly saying this is unprecedented. I've never seen anything like this and so on. So, Michael, where do you go? And I fully accept that you have not had the opportunity to review or do any research on these particular cases here, but you've seen the same documentary that you know, the three of us have seen. So what would be your overall response to the questions you'd be asking about those quite extraordinary kind of apparent miraculous healings that have been tested and so on?
Yeah, well, obviously, looking at the medical charts in detail and actually interviewing the doctors, you know, is that really what they said? Is that really what they think? It was truly a miracle. And then we got to pull back a little bit and ask, well, what are we talking about with a miracle? It can't just be, you know, million to one odds, some statistical improbability, because those things happen all the time with the law of large numbers. You know, you have millions of people doing millions of things, well, billions of people doing millions of things every day. You know, just highly unusual things are going to happen all the time, and they do. And these are coincidences and, you know, and so forth. And most religious believers, that's not what they mean. I mean, that would be in the, you know, as I joke in one of my lectures, you know, when Al Michaels proclaims, "Do you believe in miracles?" when the U.S. hockey team beat the Russian hockey team, the idea being really, really improbable, so we'll call it a miracle. I don't think that's what Christians mean. They mean, by miracle, divine intervention. Something highly unusual happened, yes, but it happened for a reason, because God intervened due to prayer or, you know, whatever. And that's what makes it a miracle. And I think there then we can ask, okay, well, if by definition you mean it's a one-off event, you know, not just highly unusual, but it wouldn't have happened without divine intervention, and therefore it's a one-off event, well, science is going to have a hard time getting at that, because by definition you're saying it's not repeatable. You know, so like, I'll give you an example. You know, maybe a decade ago or so, the Templeton Foundation funded a Harvard Medical School study on prayer and recovery from, I think it was cardiovascular illnesses in the hospital. And, you know, one group of patients had their families and professional religious people pray for them. You know, a second group, you know, had just, you know, positive thoughts sent to them, and a third group had no prayer at all. You know, so it was an attempt to, and they actually tried to quantify it, like quantified by, you know, how many days it took to recover. You know, what percentage recovered completely, or 80% or 50% or whatever, and so forth. They were trying to test the hypothesis that intercessory prayer works. And they got null results. There was no difference between the groups. And so they concluded, well, I guess, you know, at least under these conditions, prayer doesn't work. And, you know, that's an admirable attempt to test the hypothesis. But again, if you mean something different, that it's a kind of a religious truth, that would, you know, like the resurrection. Also, I'll tell you a funny story. I was at a conference with Richard Dawkins and Ken Miller and a few other scientists on science and religion. And so, you know, as you know, Richard is Dawkins is a pretty staunch atheist, and Ken Miller, I don't know if you know Ken, but he's a world-class biologist. He was kind of the pioneer of debunking intelligent design creationism, because he studies the kinds of cellular structures that intelligent design theorists were interested in. Anyway, and he wrote a whole book about this. And the last chapter of the book, he talks about how he's a Catholic and he accepts Jesus as his savior and so on. Anyway, so at this conference, Richard's saying, okay, let's say we found a piece of the true cross. you know, the piece of the wood from the true cross. And on the on that piece of wood was a little bit of flesh left over from Jesus. And we were able to extract the DNA from the flesh of Jesus. And, you know, he's born of a virgin, so he's got to have a different kind of DNA. And, it, you know, what he's driving at is there some way we can empirically test this religious claim? And before he even got there, Ken says, Richard, I'm not claiming any of this is true. In an empirical scientific sense, I'm a Catholic. This is what we believe. That's my truth. And I'm not right. trying to say I can prove it. It's just what I believe. And I thought that was really, it was honest. It was, yeah. I thought it was thoughtful. It, you know, it was kind of, I think, okay. a recognition of a kind of truth.
Okay. Well, I'd be interested in response to some of that, Craig, particularly, I think, the first issue Michael raises there, which is ultimately, unusual events are not evidence of miracles. With large numbers, million to one things happen all the time, he says. Secondly, when you have got something like double blind experiments, which have been shown that there doesn't appear to be any effect, interested in your comment on that. And who knows, maybe the story of Dawkins and Miller as well. But what's your view on both of those sort of objections, really, to the scientific claim that miracles can be tested for in that sense?
I think Michael's right about, obviously, so many things are coincidence. So we have to weigh a lot of factors to see, you know, is there a theistic context to it that tends to predominate in the cases where we have these and so on. You need a lot of cases to be able to test that. But the issue that he raises about replicability is a real issue in the sense that, you know, when we speak of God creating everything and we speak of, you know, as Christians, speak of God's handiwork being all around us, you know, those are things that can be tested for replicability, but we may disagree on the explanation, you know, or levels of causation. But miracles as one-offs, so to speak, they're not replicable. And so they're not really testable by replicable means. You can't, you know, ensure that you're going to have one the next time around. At the same time, there's all sorts of things we have to deal with that aren't replicable. Certainly in historiography, I have to deal with that. So if we want to know how somebody died, we can't kill them again to ensure that. And that's why I brought up how in different disciplines, we have to use the epistemic approach that's suitable for that discipline. And so for miracles, I think a case study approach is much better, which is why GMRI is, you know, doing things, and actually they look for things that are medically unique. So much narrower than I would look for, but trying to then go ahead and publish those in peer-reviewed journals and so on.
And just for my benefit, Craig, why, when they do that, why do you feel sympathetic to the view that what they're finding is evidence for supernatural healing rather than just extraordinary, somewhat unexplained events? What is specific about that data that suggests it isn't just a fluke, you know, one of those one in a million things that just happens sometimes?
Yeah, anomalies occur, so it's important to look for an accumulation of anomalies. So you don't just have what could be a coincidence, but a coincidental, you know, in a massive coincidence is there's something called the Lazarus syndrome, where I think in terms of documented cases where somebody, as far as anybody can tell, has been dead and they come back to life over an hour later, and they've found. The estimates I've seen have been like maybe one a year, but, and again, these aren't all medically documented, but in circles I know of people that I knew before I knew that they had stories like this, I've got like 10 of them in my immediate circle. So it's not just, unless we're burying a hugely inordinate proportion of people prematurely, these things actually do tend to happen in certain circles more than in others. And that's why for me, it would be hard for me to see it as a coincidence. I had my brother whose PhD is in physics help me calculate the probabilities of that, and he was quite, he gave me some really extraordinary probabilities on that just being a coincidence.
And to that extent, Michael, I suppose it's this point that Elijah also brought up as well. It's the context that is key. Mm-hmm. And so it's not just that, you know, unusual things happen. It's that they seem to happen more often when, at the moment, someone prays. It's in the context of a prayer that it's significant. So what's your view on that?
Well, the counterfactual. What about the Christian families who pray for their loved one who's dying from cancer and they just die? Nothing happens from the prayer. That happens all the time. You know, Christian families of Christian soldiers coming back from Iraq, Afghanistan, lost limbs and so on, and they get prayed for and they're not healed, not just loss of limbs, but all kinds of injuries. And, you know, so why are they not healed? If the context matters and we're defining a miracle as, you know, divine intervention, not just a highly improbable mm-hmm. event, then how come there's no divine intervention there? And if the answer is, well, God works in mysterious ways, who knows? Well, you know, that's kind of a hand wave. That doesn't really help us understand the phenomenon at hand.
Yeah. Elijah, go ahead.
Well, I think also calling a hand wave kind of undermines something. Is imagine you caught a murderer and you saw him shoot a guy and he goes, well, I haven't shot anyone before in my life. Is that what we're trying to show is these are real examples. I can't explain the soldier coming home. That makes perfect sense. But what I can say is there was a blind lady and she got prayer and her eyes opened up and she had macular degeneration. They can verify that before and afterwards. And I'm not sure it's rational to call those just coincidences. Like you're assuming some type of causality there. And I think if you even allow for the possibility of something like the Christian God to exist, then you've got to take seriously that it could be his action and then make an inference to the best explanation. And where I think the voice of science comes in the best is in eliminating hypotheses, not necessarily proving that's his voice. And so you can go back and go, well, there's seven different hypotheses. Science can help us with four, eliminating some, and then we've got two or three, and we've got to critically think and go, what do I think is most likely the case? And I think that's the human situation, and we make that call all the time. We make it in court.
Yeah.
We make it. So if you allow, it's possible there's a person like God exists. But if not, you've blinded yourself to the reality or the possibility of miracles. You can't be objective. You can't say, I'm an open-minded person if you can't allow for the possibility of it happening.
So you feel it's fair, once you've exhausted other possible natural explanations, to leave the God option on the table, it's okay for that to be an explanation. Obviously, some people may say, well, you know, I'm just not willing to consider that because it's something I cannot measure by definition. It's something I cannot have a physical explanation for. But for you, that itself is a form of, well, dogmatism, because they're not willing to look at this specific way of understanding things.
Right. And you got to be skeptical of your skepticism. So if you go, I don't allow for a God to exist, then you're not open-minded. And if that's the one thing people could walk away with is just, am I open-minded about miracles or not? But if you've pre-concluded there's no God, then you've already pre-concluded, you know, I could show you cases of arms growing back, theoretically speaking, and you would not believe it. You would come up with natural explanations. And so,
A naturalistic explanation would always be preferred. Well, look, we're going to go to a short break, and I'm interested to see what Michael has to say in response to all this in just a moment's time. We're talking about Miracles, the new documentary by Elijah Stevens. It's called Send Proof. We're asking, is there evidence for modern miracles? Also joining me today, Michael Shermer and Craig Keener.
You're You're listening to Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Welcome back to today's show. We're talking about miracles, something we actually explored just a few weeks ago on the show in slightly different context. We were debating Hume's maxim that extraordinary claims require extraordinary evidence. Well, we're sort of treading similarish ground today, but really looking at some very specific cases. These are part of the new video documentary by Elijah Stevens called Send Proof. Craig Keener is one of the Christian theologians and scholars who he interviews for that. So is Michael Shermer. Well, not a Christian one, more skeptical one. But we've just been talking about in that last segment about whether, you know, should we be open at least to the God explanation, a supernatural explanation, if we've ruled out other things. And that's where Elijah says, Michael, that science can be useful in helping us to at least eliminate certain explanations. And once we've eliminated possible explanations, should we not then be open to, by inference to the best explanation, to a non-scientific, in that sense, explanation, a supernatural intervention? So what's your view on that, Michael?
Yeah, I agree. We can't rule that out completely. And here I would employ something like a Bayesian reasoning approach of probabilities and not black and white, a binary where, you know, I'm going to deny God's existence and therefore there can't be miracles by definition. Then what's the point of even having a conversation about it? So, yeah, that's not helpful. There's a, you know, there's a third position that is, I don't know. Here I'll quote David, the psychologist David Myers, who's a religious man, that his definition of monotheism is there is a God and I'm not him and neither are you. So none of us know what it's like to be an omniscient being and know everything. And the secular version of that is that there is objective truth, but I don't know what it is and neither do you. And so we're left in this position of fallible beings trying to understand a complex world, and we're never going to get it right. So you have to always leave open the possibilities of there's some other explanation, for sure. And so scientists can get us to the point where we've eliminated, I don't know what, say 95% of all the claims. I use that figure just because I've been writing a lot about UAPs and UFOs. And, you know, even the hardcore UFO believers say, well, 95% of them are totally explainable. You know, they're geese or airplanes or balloons or whatever. We're just talking about this other 5% here. This is where we think, you know, you're going to find the aliens. Well, maybe, but maybe we're just never going to have 100% explanations. We're always going to have a residue of unexplained anomalies. And what do you do with them? And my answer is you don't have to do anything with them. You could just say, well, first of all, to the person that got healed, I'm glad, you know, congratulations. Good for you. That's good. You know, but if you want to drill down, but why did that happen? We may just hit a wall and just say, I don't know. You know, and no doctor is going to say, you know, for sure we know that this couldn't have happened because doctors just don't know. They're again, they're not God either. So, you know, we just have to be open to the possibility that there could be something. We just don't know what's going on there. And so that unknown is, you know, always going to be present, and that's okay. Just to say, I don't know.
Okay, Craig, what are your thoughts on that?
First, I wanted to come back to what Michael said about non-healings. That's something we all would agree on. In fact, in a biblical worldview, I mean, you know, it says so and so begot so and so, and then they died. You know, it's like pretty uniform throughout biblical teaching. You know, everybody dies. And so, again, miracles not being replicable, being one-offs, that's just, you know, that's what we're stuck with if we're going to investigate them. I think the study that you were citing, Michael, that's the STEP study. Is that the one?
No, it was Herbert Benson at Harvard that conducted that. Mm-hmm. That might have been like early 2000s. Yeah. I forget the STEP study. I think that's a different one.
Okay. Mm-hmm. All right. If I'm not mistaken, the one that Herbert Benson conducted was when they were trying to recruit people, they were having trouble getting certain participants, that all the Protestant participants were from the Unity School of Christianity, which actually doesn't believe in miracles. So, you know, okay, they had a limit. It's not the ideal way to conduct a prayer study to determine whether miracles
You can't go to the patient's family and say, okay, no prayer and praying for your exactly. your guy, because this is science. So they might have been prayed exactly. for anyway.
Yeah, it's true.
Yeah,
and I was going to say, Craig, in relation to those kinds of studies, I mean, there's one variable you can't control for, and that is obviously God. So to what extent do you think it's even possible to do a study in which you're basically testing whether God does something or not? I mean, is that wise? I don't know.
You're supposed to get informed consent from all the participants. And if God doesn't sign that he's going to participate. But, I mean, there's also the sense, I do think, you know, we should look for evidence. And I do think that, I think that there is evidence. But I also think, you know, when we look at the Gospels, Jesus was happy to heal people, to do things demonstrably. But then when some people said, no, we want a sign from heaven, mm-hmm. it's like, okay, we're not going to believe unless you do it this way. And God isn't obligated to jump through our hoops. And I think that once we say replicability, again, we are beyond the nature of miracles. In terms mm-hmm. of, there's confirmation bias, I think, that can happen either way. I think a lot of times people will see something as a miracle because we're inclined to believe in miracles. You can also have confirmation bias to say, well, I'm inclined not to see this as a miracle because I just don't think those things happen. In terms of anomalies, whether they're anomalies or whether they're explainable in some way, it helps if there's a pattern. They're not replicable, but if there's a pattern, like 9 times out of 10 where this happens, it's in the context of prayer, that should say something. Again, we need a whole lot of cases to be able to examine that. With the Bayes theorem, Thomas Bayes, I think, passed away before he was able to publish it, but Richard Price, his friend, they were both ministers and mathematicians, but Richard Price, his friend, actually published the Bayes theorem, and if I'm not mistaken, first deployed it actually to challenge Hume's probability claim regarding miracles. So I'm not an expert in Bayesian theory, and actually Michael is probably a lot stronger in it than I am, but yeah, some of those probability claims.
Well, here the idea is just to kind of try to put some numbers on it, which may or may not be applicable in one-off events like that. So then you end up evaluating the quality of the evidence, you know, the eyewitness accounts and, you know, who was reporting it and what their background was and so on. And so just to bring up a bad example that for which I think all of you would agree is not an example, Peter Popov's miraculous cures, which you can watch mm-hmm. on TV, you know, which have all been debunked. James Randi famously did this yeah. with hidden cameras and microphones and so on, where, you know, you'd see Peter Popov come up to some lady in the front row in a wheelchair and proclaim, you know, Jesus wants you to get up out of that chair right now, and then put his hand on her head and, you know, get out, demons, and so on. And then the woman gets up and she starts walking. Everybody goes, oh, my God, it's a miracle. You know, but then you find out later that, in fact, that woman walked into the tent, into the church, and they, because she was elderly, they offered her a free wheelchair, and you can sit in the front row. She's like, okay, and they wheel her down there. So no miracle occurred at all, or he appears to get the names and ailments and even home addresses of people sitting there in the audience. And then, as Randi discovered, you know, Peter Popov was wearing a little hearing device, and his wife was in the back room reading the prayer cards that everybody filled out before the session began. And so, again, no miracle, just, you know, it's a con game. And so you guys all would go, oh, yeah, okay, that's a bunch of baloney. That's not what we're talking about. Okay, so you do have standards of criteria of what's acceptable knowledge to, you know, to believe. And you have standards, and you go, okay, we're going to reject, you know, 95% of these. And then, so we're left again with this 5%. You know, what, you know, why say, well, that one right there is we're going to count in our bin of mm-hmm. true miracles, although we recognize most of them are not. You know, that there, to me, it doesn't seem like yeah. there's an established set of criteria that everybody agrees, yeah, that's the criteria we're going to use.
Well, Well, maybe you could speak to that, Elijah, mm-hmm. and you obviously referenced sure. that Peter Popoff story. Sure. In fact, you interviewed James Randi about mm-hmm. it himself right. before he passed away.
Yeah.
So firstly, maybe deal with that, the fact that obviously there are many charlatans out there and so mm-hmm. on. How does that affect the way we should mm-hmm. weigh the evidence?
Sure.
And secondly, what do you do with those anomalies, as mm-hmm. Craig and Michael have called them, and what makes them worth thinking mm-hmm. they might be true as opposed to just unknowns, really?
Sure. First of all, I love James Randi. He added so much to the conversation, and I think we all benefit from that man, and he lived and helped a lot of people, and so I just want to say that. I think this, the fact that there are fake miracles does not preclude the fact that there can be real miracles. And so knowledge falls on a continuum from this is impossible, very doubtful, 50-50, I don't know, you know, probable, highly probable, 100% certain. 2 + 2 = 4. God exists. Or excuse me, I exist. Those are the only two I know with 100% certainty. I don't put God exist with 100% certainty. And then all other truth claims, you go, I'm this confident in my belief this is true, and I will adapt if I need to. And so I don't think I don't know should be your default position unless that's really where you fall. And so what I encourage people to do is read all sides, make an inference to the best explanation, and go, this is what I think is most likely the case. Secondly, we're talking about these things objectively. Put yourself in situations where you can have experiential knowledge. Pray for sick people that you know if they would not be healed unless God showed up. And if there's one thing I hope this film does for people that are inside of the Christian faith, is that it makes them confident enough to go pray for sick people in impossible situations, because that is a means to knowledge as well. This is the thing. We're debating these things as armchair observers. Granted, that's a part of it, but I also think there's this existential element that gets lost in this conversation, that you can gain knowledge through doing.
Yeah. Talk about that a little mm-hmm. bit, because in some ways the people you're interviewing a lot mm-hmm. of the time are not philosophers or sure. theologians. They're people who sure. are going and doing stuff yeah. and say they're seeing extraordinary things. I mean, one of the most famous is Heidi sure. Baker, who for a long time has had a ministry in Mozambique mm-hmm. and on the face of it appears to see regularly all the time extraordinary right. things happen. People who right. are blind being able to see, people who were deaf being able to hear. And I think researchers have gone out and seen extraordinary things happen mm-hmm. in front of their eyes and been able to test their auditory responses and so on. So for you, Elijah, just describe some of that and why you think that doesn't just fall into the one in a million, it just sure, happened to sure. be the right day for that person to get their sight back or receive right. their hearing.
Well, there's known impossibilities. I know I can't jump to the sun. And so there are things we know that cannot happen. I think that's a part of the conversation. I also think we in the West have a bias toward poor people as not having knowledge of when something's dead or, you know, an arm is broken or something of that nature. And so I think when people put themselves in situations where they pray for the sick, and they, a whole village knows this child was born blind from birth, and they're 15 years old, and that person gets their sight back, and this is a different religion, and that village testifies, he was blind, now he sees. That is a different scenario than we're talking about here, and the lens of science really can't speak to that, but if you're that kid, you've got to go, what's more probable, that an event that just randomly happened, or the God that I was praying to gave me my sight back? And so that is a part of the conversation I think we as armchair academics, well, I don't want to use that phrase. That's pejorative. But people sitting back and watching kind of don't take into account. Like, this is life-changing stuff that's happening to these people.
Michael, before Craig comes back on that, I mean, would you be interested in going on a fact-finding kind of expedition where these sorts of things are claimed to happen, often in remote areas where, you know, medical evidence is very hard to come by for these sorts of things, but where on a regular basis people say extraordinary things are happening? Is that something, would you be thrilled to find that there genuinely were outstanding evidences for people being healed in this way?
Well, hopefully some of this happens in Southern California, so I don't have to go too far to see it. If I want to go to a malaria-infested third world country to have to witness this, presumably Christians in America can make this happen. There are cases of blindness, like psychological blindness due to trauma in war, for example, where it does come back. And no one really understands why it was not there in the first place, because the apparatus is working. The person reports they can't see. There's nothing wrong with their rods and cones and, you know, that sort of thing. And then all of a sudden they can see again. You know, there are cases of that are not considered miraculous. It's more related to, you know, PTSD and things like that. What would really impress me, I think, would be the limb, growing a limb thing. I think, Elijah, did you say you've actually seen this or documented?
No. I said theoretically. I have not seen that.
Theoretically, yeah, that would impress me, because that we know humans can't do. Salamanders could do it. Mm-hmm. They can grow back a limb. Certain lizards, you know, their tail falls off and they grow it back. And so why can't humans do that? Well, it's not in our DNA to do that. So if that happened, you know, let's say a war veteran from Afghanistan comes back and he's missing a leg, and his Christian family prays for him, and the leg grows back, and we could, you know, presumably this would happen over some period of time. It's not like the leg is just going to pop in there in a millisecond. So, you know, if you documented that, like, here's a video of this leg growing back, you know, like a time lapse video, like you'd see a salamander growing back a limb, that would do it for me. I'd say that would be
what would it do for you then? I'm interested in this, Michael, because I wanted to ask you this very question, which is, what would the bar be? Where would the level of evidence need to be for you that this was? I mean, would it convince you that something really bizarre had happened, or would it convince you that God has healed this person? What
well,
would it be?
Both, and that would, I would entertain that hypothesis more than I would have before.
Okay.
The second one, the, you know, the God did it. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, that would do it.
It would bring you a lot closer to believing there might be something in this thing than before.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Okay. Well, Craig, there is a website out there called Why Won't God Heal Amputees? And at one level, it would be great, wouldn't it? I mean, Elijah, that would have been the one thing he needed in his documentary to kind of seal the deal, video evidence of a limb growing back. Why, you know, given the fact that we have a proliferation of cameras, video devices, and everything in the century we live in, why are those kinds of very obvious, extraordinary cases of healing not yet documented? I don't know if there are cases you've heard of, perhaps, where such things have been reported. But as far as I'm aware, we've never seen any video documentary evidence of something quite that spectacular, have we?
Not one that wasn't doctored. But in terms of some of the other things, like macular degeneration, undegenerating, when it's, you know, I mean, we do have cases like that are medically documented. We have the before and after. There was one published in a medical journal within recent years. I think Elijah alluded to that. There are a number of other cases. The one that, in terms of something growing back, I mean, that's, I think, the case of Bruce Van Natta is a case in point, because the small intestine doesn't grow longer in an adult. It can grow wider, but not longer. He only had, it was estimated, 25 centimeters left of his ilium, which is normally 350 centimeters. That's why he was starving. He felt a shock when his friend laid hands on him and prayed for him. I read the note from his doctor that said that his small intestine had more than doubled in length. And we can't prove it happened exactly at that moment, but it, you know, the next time they tested him, his small intestine had more than doubled in length. Admittedly, you know, if you actually want to measure it, you'd have to cut him open and unroll it, which kind of, it's kind of counter to the point of the miracle in the first place, because you'd kill him. But
yeah.
But then we also have, with that, the gastroparesis healing with Chris Gunderson, which did make it into a medical journal. So that, I mean, that was, I interviewed Chris about this, and that was, it happened when Bruce prayed for him. He also felt an electric shock for the like 8 or 10 minutes that Bruce was praying. Immediately after that, he was able to eat. So, I mean, it is something growing back. It's not as visible as is like an arm or leg growing back. I don't know that we have a lot of those in the Bible. We have things like what they call withered hands, becoming unwithered. I have interviewed some people about, you know, who've said they've seen things grow back, but I have not seen any video.
Yeah, that would be good.
Maybe
to use another example of what happens when you look into a story in a little more detail, like that of Eben Alexander, the Harvard-trained neurologist who wrote that book, Proof of Heaven. He went to heaven. Well, when did he go to heaven? Well, when he was in a coma. Oh, he was in a coma. Okay. Why was he in a coma? Well, because he had this brain disease, this viral infection, I should say, that caused his brain to swell. So they put him in an induced coma so they could give him drugs and relieve the swelling of his brain and so on. And this is when this happened, but not just any time. It turns out when somebody finally got to, I think it was Oliver Sacks, in fact, that looked into this for one of his later I think Atlantic columns on these kind of medical miracles, that the physician that Eben Alexander had put him in this induced coma said, oh, no. He had that experience when we were bringing him out of the coma. And she said, this often happens when you're in this kind of gray area between being unconscious and conscious. You get these kind of hypnagogic and hypnopompic hallucinations where you have all kinds of just kind of weird ideas that pop into your head, these weird experiences, almost hallucinogenic experiences that happens in that kind of borderlands area. And she said that's when it happened for him. So, you know, when you read those kinds of accounts, to me, they're indistinguishable from, you know, brain chemistry kind of experiences of taking hallucinogens like LSD and others that produce those through chemistry. So how can we tell the difference between, you know, something that was probably the result of, you know, this induced coma and so on and being brought out that is not that unusual. And his claim that, you know, not only did he was dead, he claims in his book, I was dead. Brain dead. Well, his doctor says, no, he wasn't brain dead. You know, we induced his coma and his brain was, you know, it was quiet because we had shut it down basically, but he was still alive. He didn't come back from the dead. You know, so again, when you look into the story behind the book and you go, oh, okay, this is probably not a miracle.
And obviously, is it your view that a story like Craig has just outlined Bruce Van Natter and the one with Chris Gunderson. If you were to look into it, you'd probably find it's not quite as simple as it appears at first glance.
Well, that'd be my guess, yes. But, you know, I don't want to say for sure because I don't know. But I guess any kind of disease where...
Well, I think Craig wanted to come
like
back
could,
on that.
Like it couldn't happen. Like the... Okay, go ahead. Sure.
So I think you just want to come back on that, Craig, don't you?
Yeah, I mean, this isn't a case of like somebody thought they were dead and they actually weren't in terms of the, I mean, these are cases where actually, I mean, the one with Chris Gunderson, the evidence was all there before and after. It's in the medical journal. In the case of with Heidi Baker and Mozambique, of course, there was a team that went, they published the report in Southern Medical Journal in September of 2010. The backlash, as you can imagine, was pretty strong, like people saying, well, the testing conditions in rural Mozambique aren't that good. That's true. But then One of the authors of the study, Candy Gunther Brown, in her book Testing Prayer, published by Harvard University Press in 2012, she has a chapter on that study. She was there, and it wasn't like, you know, just one person. Maybe it was psychosomatic or you know, something else that they couldn't see, but it was a number of people went from blindness to seeing, from deafness to hearing. Now, Heidi's husband invited me to actually come to Mozambique and be there while some of this stuff was happening, and I didn't do it because I had other commitments, but I have other friends, PhDs, who have been there on different occasions, and these things are happening in non-Christian villages. So, I mean, the people don't have any reason to make this stuff up, or, you know, let's try to fool the Christians, because they end up starting a church the next day. And many of these people have actually had to go on and die for their new faith in Christ. They've been persecuted for it. So, again, according to standards we'd use in historiography, I mean, this is something that should really get our attention.
Mm. Elijah, I think you wanted to add something.
Yeah, I think the purpose of being a knower is to know as many true things as we can and believe as many false. And so when it comes to these like counter examples to miracles, you need them, because you can go, all right, there are cases where maybe the brain best explains this near-death experience. There's also the Journal of Evidential Near-Death Experiences, where people say, all right, I can give some type of evidence. I was able to read a barcode or something of that. And so what we have to do as knowers, and I hope our audience takes this away, is make inferences to the best explanations about the cases we're studying, not counter cases. Like, think about the case you're looking at critically and go, these are the four or five hypotheses that can happen. I can eliminate three or four. This is what I think is most probable. Here's why. And so it's good. We need that voice saying, hey, here's ones where it blurs, and you got to critically think about that to apply to these other cases. But look at each case individualistically. To outright dismiss it is to be intellectually dishonest at some level, if that makes sense.
Okay. Yeah. Well, we'll come back to Michael in just a moment. We're going to go to our final break, and we'll have a chance to wrap up this conversation on miracles, modern miracle healing claims. That's the subject of the new documentary Send Proof by Elijah Stevens. Joining us also on the show today, Craig Keener and Michael Shermer.
Listening to Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Welcome back to this week's edition of the show. Final part of the conversation on miracles between my guests Michael Shermer, Elijah Stevens and Craig Keener, coming up in just a moment. Don't forget, though, you can be part of the conversation at our Philip Yancey live webinar. That's our next Unbelievable live event on the 1st of March. You can get yourself registered and booked in absolutely free over at unbelievable.live. Really looking forward to hosting that one. Coming up later on tonight here on Premier Christian Radio, Peter Rollins is the guest of Sam Hales from Premier Christianity magazine on The Profile. Peter Rollins is an author and philosopher. He's got a reputation for overturning traditional notions of religion and forming churches that preach the good news that we can't be satisfied, that life is difficult, and that we don't know the secret. His books include Insurrection and The Orthodox Heretic. He's on The Profile tonight at 8 p.m. or on its own Profile podcast, wherever you get your podcast from. I might try and get him on Unbelievable at some time. He's a really interesting thinker, Peter Rollins. Next week here on the show, though, on Unbelievable, we're going to be talking about Bob Dylan, John Lennon and the search for God in music. I managed to get through a couple of hours of that 8-hour Beatles documentary from Peter Jackson over the holidays, Get Back. Haven't yet put aside a weekend to get through the rest of it, but it was a reminder of the massive cultural influence of the Beatles. Well, really interesting new books just come out called Dylan, Lennon, Marx and God. It's by John Stewart, who's the lead guitarist for Sleeper, who were
I was a huge Sleeper fan back in the Britpop heyday of my late teens. And he's joining me on the show as we examine the spiritual journeys of Bob Dylan and John Lennon. And we'll be joined by veteran music journalist Steve Turner. He's going to be talking about the search for God in the music of the 60s and 70s and engaging with John's own journey in and out of faith. So that's next week's Unbelievable for you. Hope you can be with us for that as well. Let's get back into the final part of this week's edition of the show. Send proof. Is there evidence for modern miracles? Michael Shermer, Craig Keener and Elijah Stevens join me. If you want to get hold of the documentary yourself, go to sendproof.com. There's a link with today's show. Michael Shermer can be found at michaelshermer.com and Craig Keener at craigkeener.com. I love it when websites are so simple because it's just the name of the person or the documentary.com. Michael, before we start to wrap up today's show, okay, give us some sense of these stories we've been hearing, the kind of specific examples that might give you pause. I mean, you've mentioned obviously a limb growing back. Well, we don't have documentary evidence of that, but we've heard
but why
about
not?
Immaculate why degeneration.
Don't we have, and, why does God seem to why does God seem to heal the things that would probably could possibly heal on their own anyway? Why not pick something that's unmistakable, like growing back a limb? Well, maybe God works in mysterious ways, or he doesn't want us to know for sure because it takes a leap of faith or something like that. So, but again, back to science, we have to have some kind of objective criteria. So if it was immaculate degeneration, I don't know enough about it to know that it never, ever reverses. I'm told it's there's no treatment for it. It just continues on until you're blind. Okay. That would be impressive if that was the case. But let me just tell you one little story about the limitations of medical science. And when doctors say this could never, ever happen. So in 1990, my mom had got a brain tumor, a meningioma brain tumor. And so we had it, retracted, and then, two more grew in. So we had surgeries on those, and then four grew in. And this thing went on for 10 years. And then all of a sudden she gets a few tumors in her lungs. And so we're like, okay, come on. This must have migrated from her brain. And the doctors, these were like the top oncologists at USC Medical Center. And they're telling us, no, that is not possible. That has never happened. It isn't possible for the cells from the brain to migrate from this kind of tumor, this meningioma brain tumor, to migrate down into the lungs. And I'm like, oh, okay, then it must be just lung cancer. It's just bad luck. Anyway, that same night, I was at a dinner party at Carol Tavris' house, the great social psychologist, and her friend, Avram Blooming, who's an oncologist, and was an early pioneer in making medical documents available online for free. So he was steeped in medical literature, and I'm telling him this story that I just told you, and he says, you know what? I think there was a paper published like 6 months ago showing that meningioma brain tumors can migrate out of the brain in other parts of the body. So sure enough, he sends me the link. I get the paper. I give it to this oncologist at USC Medical Center. They're like, whoa, wow, we had no idea. It's like, you had no idea. It took me, a non-medical person, going to a dinner party and mentioning this story to find out and tell this guy. Again, they're not gods. They can only read so much, and there's just new stuff comes up. And so the idea of like, well, medical doctors say this could never happen. Well, they're not gods. They don't know that.
Okay. Well, interesting. Craig, do you want to comment on that? And specifically, I suppose, the first objection Michael had, which is why doesn't God do things that couldn't potentially be curing themselves in the course of time? So many miracle healing claims are things that could be explained by remission or natural causes, even if they happen to occur at a time when someone prays or whatever it might be. Why not these indisputable claims? Do you have a theological reason why God may not give those kind of bulletproof examples of healing?
I don't have a theological reason why limbs wouldn't grow back. And I'm not saying that God never does that. I mean, I've read reports where people have claimed that, eyewitnesses, but I just have no way to investigate those. They're too far away. A couple cases where I actually interviewed the people. But again, it's so far out of my realm of experience that, like we talk about burden of proof in epistemology, I I'd want to see some medical records for that as well. But we do have other cases like the macular degeneration, the auditory nerve damage, and plenty of people that I've talked with have witnessed visible lumps instantly disappearing and so on. Some of them are visible. You mentioned earlier about things caught on video. Again, people can fake videos, but there's one case where she was paralyzed for 22 years, and she was a gospel singer, so all sorts of videos all over the place of her singing from her wheelchair. She had no feeling in her legs, and suddenly one time she was in a meeting where people were being prayed for. She wasn't prayed for herself. She was praying for somebody else. Suddenly feeling came to her legs. They helped her to walk around, but you know, she couldn't support her own weight. Her muscles were still atrophied, but she was moving her hips under her own power. And after she had, we do have some cases where the muscles weren't even atrophied. But normally when God does it, at least, you know, from our Christian perspective, when God heals somebody, you know, their muscles are still atrophied. So she still had to work at it. But within a month, she was walking normally. And this was after 22 years of being paralyzed. So there are things that are sometimes caught on video. There are things that are, that one was caught on video. And there are things where we do have before and after medical documentation, which is really what GMRI, I think, is where it needs to go. Because, you know, my historiographic epistemology can only carry things so far. And for people like Michael, we do need more of these. You know, we have some of them, but we definitely need more of these research claims where there are before and after medical documentation.
I suppose the tricky thing always, Michael, is going to be at what point you genuinely have something that raises to that particular bar and isn't just kind of in the, well, that's mysterious, but I'm not prepared to attribute a supernatural cause to that over something that science just hasn't yet explained, I suppose.
Right. So back to, if you already believe in God, then this is perhaps additional reasons to believe. You've got the foundation there. If you don't, then that just goes into the bin of, you know, who knows? You know, just there's a lot of mysteries. We just don't know. So it could come down something like that to what you already believe. And something like growing a limb back into the context of prayer, you know, that would tilt this, that would be the slam dunk, the home run, the, you know, make it real. You know, that appears to be off the table. Well, okay. Darn. You know, why isn't really clear? I mean, I have nothing against believing in a God. There might be a God. I don't know. I'm kind of ontologically agnostic on that, in the sense that it's not knowable ultimately, although I act like I'm an atheist and I just assume there isn't a God for the time being. But I'm happy to wake up when my time comes in some other realm. You know, I'm in the quantum field that Deepak Chopra thinks is heaven, or I'm in the Christian heaven. Hopefully that'll be a good place to be. And so on. I have nothing against it, but the question is, you know, is it true or not? And well, yeah, that's the point of this discussion.
At this point, you remain unconvinced. Elijah, perhaps we'll finish with you as we round out today's show. Mm-hmm. Obviously, in the course of that documentary, you were talking to skeptics and Christians, mm-hmm. people who claimed miracles, people who had been disappointed as well. You mentioned this pastor mm-hmm. friend of yours who features near the beginning of the documentary, who became an atheist because he was in a charismatic denomination, but he wasn't seeing the miracles he was told he should see. And a lot of the time, our experiences actually are about disappointment in the way that Michael explains. And the only reason miracles are what they are, miracles, is because they are quite rare, actually, even mm-hmm. though you've tracked down some pretty extraordinary claims of miracles. So how do you balance all of that, the fact that in the normal course of things, this is quite unusual, and many Christians who would love to see something that confirms their mm-hmm. faith in that way, but many times don't. Mm-hmm. Is that, I suppose, the point of what you're doing, GMRI, to say, okay, but it does happen, and here's some proof?
Yes, at some level, I hope that Christians watch this and pray for the sick, that we get past our fear and that we record if and when God does something and that we're intellectually honest about it in the process. But there are a lot of people not healed because Christians don't live the teachings of Jesus.
So if you don't pray in the first place, then you're very unlikely to see anyone get healed.
Sure.
If you don't, yeah, try it out. It's a bit like the people who say, I never play the lottery because I know I won't win. Well, how do you know you won't win unless you've tried playing it? Yeah. Interesting stuff. Thank you so much. And such an interesting conversation. I've really enjoyed all of this that we've had today between you, Craig, Elijah and Michael today. If you want, again, the documentary itself, sendproof.com. I found it fascinating, very well produced. Whether or not you come away convinced, I think you'll find it a worthwhile watch. MichaelShermer.com and CraigKeener.com for Craig and Michael's sites. But for now, thank you all for a fascinating discussion.
All right.
Yeah, I'd love to know what you made of today's discussion. Always good to hear your feedback. You can email me unbelievable@premier.org.uk. You can get in touch via our social media. On Facebook, it's facebook.com/premierunbelievable. You can contact me via @unbelievablejb on Twitter. Of course, there's our YouTube channel as well, where you can find today's show on video and see more of our video discussions and so on. Thanks so much to David, Erin and Elliot out in Vancouver, Canada. And David emailed to say, I wanted to let you know that after listening to your recent podcast interview with Joby Martin, I was inspired to look into compassion. Can now say that my family and I are sponsoring a child in Peru whose name is Rosalinda. Just wanted to let you know you can count on another sponsorship in your target of reaching 100 sponsored children. And would like to take a second to thank you and the team for the amazing show you put on. Always a blessing. Thank you, David and Erin and Elliot. And for anyone who's wondering what this is about, it's because we just had on our most recent podcast a special interview I did with Joby Martin from the Church of 1122 about sponsorship compassion. Now, that's primarily aimed at folk in the USA who can sponsor through Compassion USA, but any sponsorship from anywhere is wonderful. So thank you from Canada sponsoring as well, David. But if you want more from that, just go to compassion.com/Justin to be able to sponsor a child through the Unbelievable Show. And if you're doing that from the USA, then you get a copy of my book, Unbelievable: Why After 10 Years of Talking with Atheists I'm Still a Christian, and at the moment Joby Martin's book, If the Tomb is Empty. But lovely to hear that story, David. If you've been inspired to sponsor a child through the show, do let me know, and I'll give you a shout out. But it's great to know that people are already sponsoring. I've heard back from Compassion to say that they've seen a number of responses already as we try to sponsor another whole village of children this year through Unbelievable. Wouldn't that be fantastic? Thanks to Glenn as well, who got in touch to say, I lost both my parents in the pandemic, Justin. I'm agnostic, but have so enjoyed watching the Unbelievable Show. It's given me hope and helped me move forward and question everything. Thank you so much. Please keep going. God bless you, Glenn. Thank you so much. I love it when that's the kind of message that honestly makes my day, Glenn. So thank you so much. We had, you know, a couple of weeks ago, a quite feisty, interrupty kind of debate between Jane Ozan and Peter Linus. Lots of email still coming on that, their discussion, their debate, really, on the ban gay conversion therapy bill. This one in, though, from Ordinary Witness on Twitter on last week's show, which was Preston Ulmer and Guy McDermott talking about the Doubters Club and can a doubter find a place in church, just said this on Twitter. Ordinary Witness said, a much welcomed, respectful discussion after last week's interruption riddled episode. Both Preston and Guy mould their own goal to be reflective listeners on their own journey of belief. Nice pair up. Thank you, Justin and the team. Thank you very much for that lovely message. Not a lot else actually come in response to that yet. So if you've got thoughts on the Doubters Club episode, feel free to email them in or send them in some way on social media.
Lots and lots of emails still coming in, though, in response to the gay conversion debate between Peter Linus and Jane Ozanne. Let's hear some of your feedback to that. Matt in Tayport says, I enjoy listening to the show each week. Fascinating and insightful conversation. Always a highlight while I cook. I was interested to hear the point of view shared by Jane Ozanne. It was a perspective I've not considered, and I found it incredibly helpful. She may have brought me round to her position, but she massively undermined herself by constant interruptions of Peter Linus, which at times verged on the hysterical. Peter could hardly make a point without her butting in. At one point, I shouted at her to let him speak, which drew some surprised and wary looks from other people on the bus. I don't know how Peter kept his cool for so long, though. His frustration was evident by the end. Keep up the good work. Thanks, Matt. Glad you found it helpful. Tim out in Canada says, I haven't ridden in a long while, but that last episode was too good to pass up. In your discussion, Jane put a great deal of stress on what love is and what harm means, because there are individuals who unfortunately suffer greatly due to the notion of being told they're living a sinful lifestyle. The point of view is understandable. However, it begs the question, what of general conversion? Isn't the whole message of Romans built on the notion that all mankind is living a sinful lifestyle and must change their ways? Isn't the whole concept of Christianity that it's not easy and living a God-ordered life will put you at odds with society and what is commonly acceptable? When one takes a step back, the argument against conversion therapy in the sexual sense is merely a prelude to banning religious conversion altogether. Some would then say that indeed all conversion should be banned, but it comes down to the question of who has the authority to say what is right and what is wrong. If man is the arbiter of law, then that which is right is confined within a man-centered myopic view of reality. If Jesus is Lord of Lords, then irrespective of what one may see as good for me or good for you, we must submit to the highest authority. I don't like the fact that the Bible tells me I'm sinful and my heart is desperately wicked, but if that's the truth, it really doesn't matter how I feel about it. To paraphrase a well-known American Jewish political commentator, facts don't care about your feelings. Thanks for the conversation. Having guests that get hot under the collar is refreshing from time to time. It brings about the reality that these topics are not relegated to ivory towers, but rather they're things that commoners are passionate about and their implications have a real, tangible result in society. Thank you, Tim in Saskatoon, Canada. Kevin King gets in touch to say, I'm very conscious of the extent to which the facts of the conversion therapy ban have been consistently misrepresented to the public. Yet most folks I speak to still don't even know that a consultation has been taking place. It's about to end at the time this show comes out as well, Kevin. Kevin, you say, I was heavily addicted to sex myself and close to becoming a practicing homosexual at the age of 14 when Jesus came into my life and changed my whole outlook. So I can really empathize with what Jane has gone through. But I'm also a scientist. I did my BSc honours thesis on free will and determinism in relation to brain science. So I can say with reasonable confidence, having studied both the Coventry report and a number of the key research papers, that the government's alleged evidence is plain bad science. Robbie in Australia says, in particular, I want to write about Linus's use of the Genesis text to justify a traditional male-female view of marriage, which I think is problematic. While I think it's possible to read the text in the way Linus does, I think Ozanne is correct that the main emphasis is placed on love, not gender, particularly when it's reiterated by Jesus in Matthew. The description of the creation of humans as male and female, both in Genesis and by Jesus, is very similar to the Greek mythology of the soulmate, that each soul was split into two complementary parts, male and female, and that those two halves of the soul are incomplete until they find each other. In both cases, I believe the emphasis of the story is placed on the love between two individuals who come together to complete each other rather than their gender, and I believe Ozanne expressed a similar interpretation. That's further supported by the fact that God has created us so that there are more differences between any two human beings of the same or opposite gender than there are between any statistical grouping of female and male traits. I'm not saying that the traditional interpretation is inconsistent with a text. I'm rather suggesting that the text is open to multiple interpretations, and so one can't use it to justify one specific point of view in favour of another. Accordingly, I think someone who takes a traditional approach to this should therefore acknowledge the validity of alternative points of view and not expect others to conform to that point of view, even if they choose to do so themselves. And you go on to say that you felt the topic was broadly similar to that superb homosexuality debate hosted between Brandon Robertson and David Bennett back in February 2020, when Robertson and Bennett did wonderfully well in accepting that they both have differing but valid perspectives. Thank you very much. I'm glad that you got a lot out of that, though, Robbie. Also, from that part of the world, Chris Spark says, I'm in New Zealand and have been discussing it here too. These are tricky and very sensitive and personal issues, which the church has not generally dealt with well historically. So it's important we have careful listening and respectful discussions. As someone with close connections to a number of gay people inside the church and outside, and who's been part of a divided denomination over issues that have come to a head around sexuality, I feel this strongly. That's why I found it hard to listen to Jane O'Zan, often as she seemed to try to talk over Peter Lyonis. It seemed as if he couldn't say anything she even mildly disagreed with without her having to jump in and try to talk over him. What Peter Lyonis said at the end about the logic of harm, i.e. that if Jane thinks the teaching itself of a traditional or conservative view on sexual ethics is harmful, it may well follow she would seek to have that banned too, was running through my mind earlier in the discussion, flowing out of what Jane said. So it was interesting to hear Peter ask her about it. I accept her response, though, that she doesn't see how she could do such a thing and doesn't think she should. A small point, it sounded at times from Jane as if Autoria New Zealand had passed similar legislation. Well, we haven't. It is actually still in the committee stage. Seems likely to pass in some form, but whether amendments, etc., will be made is yet to be seen. But finally, what Jane said about people like Ed Shaw I found particularly frustrating. Ed's beautiful and deeply challenging book, The Plausibility Problem, which she referred to, is one of the best books I have read on pastoral issues around sexuality. He's honest and raw about both the joys and difficulties of following Christ as a celibate gay Christian, while powerfully challenging the evangelical church to better care for gay Christians. To caricature his honesty as being something of an expression of harm is to grossly distort his book. If people want to hear a genuine representation of his position and that of others, they could listen to the testimonies in season one of the Living Out podcast, which Ed helps to run. You will again hear honest and very human stories of people who are seeking to live this particular path of Christian discipleship. It is beautiful, challenging, and inspiring listening, discussing real Christian discipleship with its highs and lows as these dear people take up their crosses and follow Christ. It's often quite witty too, in that dry English kind of way. By the way, the idea of having someone like Ed or Anne Witten from Living Out on with someone from the affirming camp like Jane to discuss the story of celibate gay Christians and whether it's a sustainable and joyful path of discipleship, well, that would be fascinating. Thanks for organising and facilitating these important discussions. And you sign off with Manaaki te atua, God bless, which I assume is a local dialect for New Zealand. Thank you, Chris. Trevor over in Belfast wants to say the podcast on conversion therapy was very good and helpful. Well done, Peter, for being patient, and Justin for asking for clarification on terms that most people wouldn't know about. I would have liked to ask about the following, though. Firstly, does love mean people can and should do what they want? That seems to be what Jane is saying. What does it mean that Jesus came full of grace and truth? I think both extremes have problems. A, only truth leads to a harsh judgmentalism. B, only grace leads to do what you want. Neither seems satisfactory or Jesus-like. I think we need to be graceful with people and all strive towards truth. Of course, we may disagree what truth is, but to equate love with whatever the person wants doesn't seem very biblical. Number two, in following Jesus' disciples, is there a legitimate role for self-control, attitude and behaviour change, and done in a communal context? For example, if I have natural desires for many partners, polyamorous or even pansexual, should I be true to myself and live like that as long as everyone involved agrees and isn't harmed? Currently, I could go to some church leaders and get prayer to help me live a pure life. Should that also be banned, as I'm not being authentic to how I'm made, i.e. trying to change or suppress my natural desires? And thirdly, some of the thinking seems to be based on a Western hyper-individualistic view of human rights, where the person is God and no thought for the effect on community. Anyway, keep up the high-quality work. It's a real blessing to us all, says Trevor in Belfast, Ireland. Why don't we just do one more? Wesley in County Armagh says, in response to the recent show on gay conversion, I thought Peter Lyonis presented clearly that he was against potentially harmful practices. They should be banned. But I thought Jane failed to present her case without shouting over her opponent. She failed to present her case without falling back on her own personal preferences on how and what would harm a person. Her views on the legislation would effectively criminalise religious freedoms for the sake of her personal preference. The most glaring problem from Jane's case was the assumptions behind her views and the massive inconsistencies they lead to. She assumed that a gay person who chooses to explore not following sexual desires should not be able to get help to do so. This presupposes that sexuality is a fundamentally critical part of their life that they cannot submit. Yet all Christians believe in submitting their sexual desires to God in some respect. Heterosexuals have to confront that God requires them to not fully express their sexual desires even in their thoughts. They have to submit themselves to the bounds of monogamy and accept limitations placed on them by a partner. Asexual Christians who desire marriage but lack a desire for sex are instructed to submit their sexual desires for the sake of their marriage. And those attracted in sex in any way considered immoral by the scriptures are required to submit their sexual desires to God. Those who suffer childhood sexual assault are also shown in studies such as the reference below to exhibit hypersexual behavior. Are those people not able to seek help to resist their sexual desires, even though they were potentially caused by the abuse of another party? And you reference the particular study in question there. Anyway, you finish off here by saying, Jane's views assume that if you're homosexual, you're afforded a special privilege and should not consider submitting your sexuality to God, even though scripture is full of references to demonstrate that desires are misleading, don't satisfy in the end, and can cause us damage spiritually. I begin to wonder if she's ever studied scriptures because these principles appear to be lost on her. I fear her views are incoherent because of their hyper-focus on the rights of one special group, without considering the restrictions it places on the freedoms of others. This is why Peter brought consent into the discussion. We all need to be free to consent to what we believe is good for us, free from the restrictions imposed by narrow-minded government legislation. There you go. That just about got us to the bottom of the mailbag on that episode on the gay conversion debate. But yeah, always open to hearing more from you. And next week, maybe we'll get some of your thoughts on today's miracle episode and maybe join it in with some of the voluminous feedback we've also had on that extraordinary claims and extraordinary evidence debate of a few weeks ago with Jonathan McClatchy and Jonathan Pierce. But for now, thank you very much for being with us on today's edition of the show. Just a final reminder before we sign off that we've got this wonderful Ask Philip Yancey Anything Unbelievable live event going on Tuesday, the 1st of March. You can be part of it by simply signing up for free at unbelievable.live. Philip has a new autobiography, Where the Light Fell. We'll be talking about that, and you can ask any question you like, more or less, to the person who has probably been one of the most influential voices in the global evangelical church in the last few decades. So don't miss our Ask Philip Yancey Anything live event, Tuesday, the 1st of March, 8 p.m. UK, 3 p.m. Eastern. Unbelievable.live is the place to go. The link's with today's show as well if you want to get yourself booked in. For now, thanks for being with us. On next week's show, we're talking about Bob Dylan, John Lennon, and the search for God in music. John Stewart, lead guitarist for Sleeper, is joining me as we examine the spiritual journeys of Bob Dylan and John Lennon in his new book, Dylan, Lennon, Marx, and God. Also joined by veteran music journalist Steve Turner. He's spoken to so many huge stars of the music scene. He's interviewed John Lennon, for goodness sake, back in 1971. Anyway, Steve's joining us for this conversation about the search for God in the music of the 60s and 70s and engaging with John's own journey in and out of faith. Really interesting edition of the show for you next week. Hope you can be with us for that. Until then, God bless. See you next time.